Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven, stay driven.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Bareback Facts. I am your host, Dallas Duclo, and today I'm going to be talking about race. Now, ordinarily, I give you guys a little bit of background, but today I just want to give you a little bit of a definition first to distinguish from what ordinarily be considered kind of a no-brainer thing. You know, many people are going to say, oh, well, aren't race like, you know, ghosts? Well, they are, and they aren't. So I want to make a little bit of a distinction first. So we'll start with the definition. Now, Merriam-Webster has a pretty good definition of what a race is. A race is the exact likeness of a living person seen usually just before death as an apparition. So it's a little bit different than a ghost. It's the exact likeness of a living person seen usually just before death apparition. Now, an apparition is a spectral being, a spirit, if you will, which could be construed as a ghost. But the main difference between a wraith and a ghost is that ghosts haunt places. Ghosts are spirits that didn't pass on, that are stuck in a particular place. They are stuck in going through the motions, wherever they were, whatever they're doing. And, you know, We hear stories of ghosts that are stuck in one house. They're stuck in a graveyard. Ghosts are always stuck in, tend to go through a routine. They are stuck in that routine. They are in a loop. They're going nowhere. Wraiths, however, are different. They appear in the likeness of an individual person that you might know, and they are a little bit more sinister. They have some semblance of will, but they are unable to find their way to the afterlife. Now, wraiths often are associated with beings such as the Grim Reaper, but there's a difference. This myth is not common, nor is it easy to find particularly reliable information about it, but wraiths are said to be, in some cases, some form of manipulated spirit that exists as a result of sorcery. Now, depending on what stories you read about wraiths, it's said that wraiths can feed on the spiritual energy of a living being. Wraith itself, the word, is actually a Scottish term for ghost. The word for ghost. But as we know them, wraiths are a little bit tricky, to say the least. Essentially, they're more like phantoms or just simply malevolent beings. They more closely resemble the Greek mythological shade. If you're not familiar with a shade, when you look at Greek mythology, you look at stories such as the story of Orpheus, the man who made a deal with Hades that he could take his wife, his lover, or wife, depending on the variation of the story that you listen to, from the afterlife, from the underworld, back to the land of the living. And the result was that he had made an agreement with Hades that he could take her, but he is not to look back at her until they are out of Hades, they are out of the underworld. Now, if he were to look back at her before then the deal is off. And, of course, Orpheus gets very scared that he's lost her in the tunnels on his way up to the surface, and he foolishly looks back. He sees her for the last time, and she is whisked back down to the underworld for the rest of time until, you know, of course, he dies and gets to meet her. But he would never see her again in the land of the living, was the agreement. Now, on his way through the underworld, Orpheus sees a number of interesting individuals who he believes at first are alive, but then recognizes them as actually shades. And shades are similar to wraiths. They are the embodiment, the spiritual embodiment of people who were once alive but are no longer alive. They have a clear physical appearance, but they can walk through walls. You can look right through them. They're very ghost-like, but nonetheless, they're a little bit different. These shades are constantly roaming the underworld, trying to find their way to a place of final judgment, and occasionally they wander out of the underworld into the land of living because they are spirits that will not be able to find rest. So these shades have no clear purpose other than the fact that they are simply lost. Shades are lost between our world and the realm of the spirits. They cannot pass forward into judgment. They will not be able to go and face their final judgment. They are, in a sense, in a constant state of purgatory, in that they are both unable to really communicate. They can't really communicate with you unless, this varies from myth to myth. Occasionally in stories, we have people attempt to communicate with shades through various forms of black magic. But, or oracles, for that matter. The Greeks believed that oracles could summon shades, could summon the shade of a person who was once alive and pull them from the afterlife into the world of the living to engage them in conversation and consult them for their knowledge. It was believed by many that the Oracle of Delphi could do this. But, you know, these are just stories that people have told. We have no way of corroborating that this is actually possible. Nonetheless, these shades or wraiths were pulled are individuals that are not able to cross over into the next realm into a peaceful afterlife. They are stuck. What makes wraiths and shades in particular different from ghosts is that shades or wraiths in particular can actually hurt you. There are numerous stories about what wraiths do. Wraiths, in many cases, are thought to be, if there is such a thing as a bad ghost, wraiths are it. In every single incarnation of wraiths that we have in stories, wraiths are summoned by sorcerers or necromancers. And if you're not sure what a necromancer is, a necromancer is an individual who performs magic on the dead, a person who attempts to manipulate the barrier between the living and the dead, and to bring individuals back from the other side, often for nefarious purposes. Now, I'm not going to say that there are necromancers or that there were necromancers, but there were people who believed that they could do this, and there were other people, and there were people who believed that this was possible. And that's what makes it particularly important. Now, people believed that wraiths were summoned to torment people who were alive. So wraiths have a very specific purpose. They're beings that in many cases are brought back. They are the souls of departed individuals who are brought back, tormented by various dark magics, and then they are placed essentially on the hunt for living souls. They must feed on physical energy in order to sustain themselves and maintain their presence here. Otherwise, they will be reverted back to this state of limbo in which they were in. So they must feed upon physical energy. And what that means is they must come in contact with living beings. They must get in contact with a physical human being, a person who has a physical form that is still alive. They feed on life force itself. They drain you of your vitality. And I don't mean they bite you and suck out your blood. I mean they take your spiritual energy, the physical energy that sustains you. They take it to sustain themselves. In other stories, people believe that wraiths were once people who practiced dark magic, and these people tried to extend their lives for many years, but the result was not what they expected, as their bodies would eventually, of course, crumble. Due to time, your body, of course, decomposes over time. So all that is left of this individual is a soul that is deprived of substance, and which the person whose mind in this soul has now been driven mad by its most hideous fears. Wraiths are ethereal creatures so that they can move through solid objects, and their faces are tortured souls. The presence of a wraith brings terror, and they are noted for an air of extreme coldness around them. So wraiths are said to be tormented souls, or the souls of people who practice dark magic in an attempt to discover the secrets to immortality. And these secrets ended up costing them more than they bargained for. Now, if we look at in the sense of popular culture, they change again. This is what makes this particular entity fascinating, because wraiths have really this very ethereal, they're an ethereal being, right? They can pass through objects. They possess a physical appearance. They don't possess a physical form, which makes them really tricky to pin down. It makes them very tricky to pin down, at least in the context of defining what they are and what they can do and what their capabilities are. This makes it actually much easier for people to take the word wraith and apply it to other things. It also makes it a much more pliable story, which is why wraiths appear so prominently in so many different forms of literature. Wraiths appear in Macbeth, although they refer to as shades. They appear as Banquo. Banquo's wraith appears to torment Macbeth in the play, the old Scottish play, as the Doors will tell you it's called, because you're not supposed to say Macbeth because it's bad luck. The supposed reason, however, of why the old Scottish play is bad luck, incidentally, is because it is believed that the wraiths of the original actors who performed the play might come and haunt you, and is also believed that bad things will happen to you because there's a number of stories involving spooky things surrounding the play itself. However, that is neither here nor there. What is particularly interesting is that not only do wraiths appear in this Scottish play, but they also appear prominently in more contemporary literature. For example, we have the entire Harry Potter series to consult. In the Harry Potter series, we have an abundance of ghosts and spectral creatures and fantastical beasts of all sorts, shapes, and sizes. But one that appears in the novels and carries with it an air of absolute terror is one that is called the Dementor, which bears striking resemblance to descriptions of the wraith. So we look at the Dementor in the film and in the novel. It is a being that possesses a black shroud, which wraiths often do possess an appearance of being a shaded figure, a hooded black figure, which is why they're often at times associated with the Grim Reaper and they're associated with death. They are said to be hooded figures that can also bear a physical resemblance of a person who has either recently died or a person who is not yet dead, but appears to be so. And what that means is wraiths can also appear as people who are not dead, but they trick you into believing that they are dead. So they can appear as your relative who is not dead and terrify the bejesus out of you because you think, oh my gosh, my relative died and I had no idea. And that's so that they can get you close to feed on their most favorite meal of all, fear. Wraiths don't go after people for their physical and spiritual energy. They like to devour fear itself. They feed and gorge themselves on emotional energy. And for them, fear is like, it's like sweet strawberry sundaes to them. They are down with that stuff. They are all about that life, or in this case, all about that death, because they are dead. But if we look at the Dementors in Harry Potter, they bear striking resemblance to stories about wraiths. They're hooded black figures that possess a somewhat physical appearance. They look like they have a physical form, and yet they pass through buildings. It looks as though they could actually reach right through you, and in a sense they can, but they can also touch you. And this is important, because ghosts can't touch you. That's one huge distinction between wraiths and ghosts, form and all. They cannot touch you. They can pass through objects, but they can't make themselves solid to grab you. They can move things, but they can't physically embrace you. They cannot touch you. Wraiths can touch you. In fact, in the Scottish tales that we have about wraiths, wraiths are actually said to come up out of the marshes and actually try to grab your feet, pull you into the bogs. Wraiths can touch you. Their fingers are they've got these long, slender fingers that they wrap around you. And when they do, their touch is said to be extremely cold. Now, if we look at the story of within Harry Potter involving the Dementors cause the air around them to become incredibly cold. Their breath is cold. Their touch is cold. When they touch things, those things freeze. When they go past water, it freezes up. Everybody's breath turns cold. This is qualities of the wraith. Where they go, things get cold. And what they touch feels cold. There is no real life in them. And that is where this coldness comes from. It is believed that the wraith carries around the very chill air of death itself with it, wherever it goes. And so that is why the Dementor in Harry Potter is, in effect, a wraith and not a ghost. Why is this important? Well, it's a revival of this old story, but made popular by the series. And Dementors feature prominently in the series. They appear in, I believe, 2 to 3 novels. They also appear in multiple films across the series. And incidentally, the only thing that can drive away wraiths in the mythos is either, when we look at them from a mythological standpoint, the only thing that could drive them out in the early ancient days, this is for a long list of reasons we won't get into, post-Christianity could just trump everything. The idea was that one of the major things that early Christians tried to posit was that their God was greater than anything that could possibly exist. And so, of course, it would triumph over all these quote-unquote pagan ideas. So ghosts and spirits and goblins and all these things that people had believed in before, well, that's just, you don't have to worry about that anymore because God is God and he can just take care of it. So it's the ultimate write-off for Christians was you don't have to worry about any of that. Fairies and wraiths and all that stuff because God's so awesome he'll just get rid of all of it for you, and that's, you know, it's a blanket, it's sort of blanket coverage. It's like a full-on insurance policy, but that's neither here nor there. In pre-Christian times, the only way to drive out wraiths was the presence of light. They were driven away by light. Wraiths can't go where there is bright light. They're almost entirely composed of shadows and darkness. And darkness is driven away by light. So naturally, and it is, of course, also the opposite of light. In this case, opposites don't attract, they repel one another. And so wraiths could only be driven out by the presence of light. So that means you have to light a candle or carry a torch or light a big fire and sit around it, and then that would keep them away. Also, it was thought that the heat of a good fire would keep wraiths away because they're cold. And, of course, one thing that is important to note is that fire, is the substance that most often early people associated with life. Why? Because fire could not only provide you with warmth with which you would need to survive during periods in which it was very cold, but it was also a means of making tools and, of course, preparing meals, which, of course, allow you to sustain yourself. So fire is and has always been a symbol of life. It's a symbol of vitality, of passion, of energy, but of life. Winter is oftentimes been used symbolically to represent death. Cold has been symbolically used, this feeling of cold air has often symbolically been used to represent the presence of death. Death's t- touch, the Grim Reaper's touch, is said to be incredibly cold. The presence of spirits is said to make the air around you cold. The presence of undead, vampires, demons, they're supposed to make things cold. And wraiths are no exception to the rule. They bring with them cold. They have no life in them. They don't have the fire, the heat of life within them. And so, of course, where they go, things are cold. And they themselves are cold. So it's no surprise that we see this association with wraiths, this association with cold and death being sort of intertwined in this scenario, which is why the presence of Dementors in a children's novel, in the later iterations of the novel, the sequels to the original novel, become more adult in nature as you go forth. It's a bit of a coming-of-age story, but a series of books that forms sort of a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story in which Harry Potter goes from being a young boy to a young man. So, of course, the subject matter is going to get a little bit more complex as we go forward. But still, this set of stories is directed predominantly at young people. And wraiths are nothing to be, they're nothing to scoff at. They're pretty terrifying figures. The stories we have about them are of them carrying death itself. In some stories, we have wraiths appearing at the side of a physical manifestation of death, the Grim Reaper. They are said to go forth at the beckoning of death to seek out his newest victim. So where wraiths go, death is shortly to follow behind them. So they are harbingers of what is to come, death itself. So in essence, they are both harbingers, but also the tools of death, which makes them a little bit more terrifying. And when we look at Harry Potter as a series, there is some dark things in there. Of course, we have a story about an evil wizard who wipes out the main character's whole family. And then, so the novel's trying to figure out how to kill him. That's some pretty dark material. But, I find the addition of the Dementors to be sort of over the top and also very fascinating, because it's interesting how Rowling is able to take this concept of the wraith and thread it in there and create this unique being that feeds on happiness and feeds on the happiest memories that we've ever had by bringing up the worst memories we've ever had. Now, while there's not really, to my knowledge, a bunch of stories about wraiths influencing dreams, they do appear in nightmares, which is a curious thing to consider. And they are said to be the objects of visions. So wraiths can appear during visions. So something interesting there to consider. But when we look at wraiths in this particular context, these Dementors' particular job is, interestingly enough, is to torment prisoners, which I find to be pretty fitting, because if we look at wraiths on the whole, wraiths, their job is at least in the context of the mythos involving them with death, is to go forth and find the next person who death is supposed to claim. But they're also tormented souls in and of themselves. They themselves are tormented souls who have no choice but to perform this task, or whatever tasks they are bent to by evil magics or sorcerers or necromancers or death itself, because they have little will of their own. The will that they do have is a will that can be easily bent by those with a solid will of their own. Whereas, ghosts are kind of just trapped here. Wraiths are not only trapped here, but they are subject to the whims of those who would impose their will upon them. And ghosts, on the other hand, are not so much. Ghosts kind of just do their own thing. They kind of go through the motions, the same motions they were going through while they were alive, they're going through now. Wraiths are very active, very, very active entities, whose existence plagues the living. Case of the Harry Potter example, the Dementors, they do a similar thing. While they do perform a task, And that task is to maintain sort of punishment for the worst of the worst criminals. They also torment people who've had, you know, terrible experiences and feed on what little happiness and life energy that they have. They leave their victims completely drained and weakened by their presence, which is very similar to wraiths. Now, wraiths appear again, but more actively in another incredibly popular piece of literature, or sets of pieces of literature, I should say, another popular series. They appear prominently in the Lord of the Rings series, the Ring Wraiths. Now, according to Tolkien, in his writings, a wraith is a person who has been killed but yet lives on by some form of dark sorcery, necromancy, or in the case of Tolkien's novel, there is the presence of a weapon known as a Morgul blade, which is a blade forged, a poisonous blade that is forged in this horrible land in his novels known as Mordor, a hellish landscape in which only the darkest and most twisted beings exist to plague mankind, elf kind, what have you, the various characters and races that he has within his universe called Middle Earth. Now, according to him, wraiths are somebody who has been killed yet lives on by some dark sorcery, so they are an undead being, or as a result of necromancy or being stabbed by a Morgul blade. But it's also someone who died in darkness or serious dishonor. So one thing that's particularly interesting is that within the Scottish context, wraiths can be people who were particularly dishonorable while they were alive. So dishonorable, in fact, that they couldn't pass on to the next side. They couldn't because neither hell nor heaven wanted them. And what a terrifying prospect. When we think about dishonorable figures within the Scottish context, and really within a more European context, dishonorable tended to mean people who broke their word, so oath breakers, people who lied and cheated, swindlers, liars, and worst of all, perhaps worse than any of these, is cowards. It is, you know, within many stories about wraiths that we have, particularly in the Scottish context, cowards, people who were cowardly, who shirked their responsibilities out of fear and then died, were punished by becoming wraiths, these sort of lifeless beings whose sole purpose was to feed and torment on the living, feed on the energies of the living and torment others. Because while they were alive, they couldn't make it on their own steam. So what should make it different in death? So as if they weren't a big pain in the ass while they were alive, they've got to be a pain in the ass while they're dead. That's the way it goes with wraiths and vampires and the like. These spirits that we have that are sort of lessons to learn from, in that you don't want to be a wraith, right? You don't want to be an individual who shirked duty, who turned your back on responsibilities and died. Even worse than that, though, within these stories of wraiths, is the idea that a wraith can be a person who not only died after shirking their duty, but they could be a person who died because they shirked their duty. So a person who died for not fulfilling their obligations they'd agreed to, but also a person who died as a consequence of breaking their word. So in many cases, people that were said to become wraiths were traitors, or people who turned their back on their responsibilities and got murdered for it. And they're cursed by being wraiths. So not only were they cursed in life because they got murdered, obviously, for turning their back on their word, you know, forsaking their word, forsaking their loyalties, but then they are punished further by being forced to become wraiths. Now, we're going to take a commercial break, but before we do, as always, we want to thank our sponsors for all that they do, keeping us on the air. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about more about wraiths in the context of the Lord of the Rings series and how Tolkien sort of adapted the story of the wraith to suit his own purposes. And it's actually quite fascinating. So I hope you guys are enjoying the show, because we're going to take a look at that when we return, I should say. Sorry, I got a little choked up there. But before we take our commercial break, we do have a proud new sponsor of Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, he's crazy, and he's totally driven. You guys will want to check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com. I will see you guys all back very shortly, and we'll continue our discussion of wraiths, and we'll talk a little bit about Tolkien's usage of them.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hope you guys enjoyed the commercial break. That was a good chance for me to refuel, get a little bit of water. And now, I wanted to talk before the break, I know I mentioned how J.R.R. Tolkien introduced the Wraith to the audience, and not just in his literature, but also, of course, the films that followed later, in very popular and recognizable figures. And I know that a lot of people have probably seen the Lord of the Rings movies. In those films, we see some very dark hooded figures known as the Ringwraiths. These individuals are very dark figures in within his universe. One of them in particular is a major antagonist in the book known as the Witch King of Angmar. And in the first book, we find out that he is the individual who stabs our main character with a mortal blade and nearly turns him into a wraith, making him this sort of cursed being. So these ring wraiths, interestingly enough, are oath breakers. They are men who turn their backs on their duty within the Lord of the Rings. In Tolkien's book, he refers to them as the Nazgul. The Nazgul are in a sense the same thing. They're also called the Ringwraiths for those outside of the. For those who have read the books, there are multiple names for them. They are referred to as the Nine. They're referred to as the Black Riders, the Fell Riders, and Fell meaning that they are cursed spirits. And then finally, Ringwraiths. These individuals were nine men who succumbed to the Dark Lords in Sauron within the Lord of the Rings book. Sauron is the primary antagonist. He is the bad guy of bad guys. He is the ruler of Mordor, this hellish kingdom that I mentioned before the break, where all sorts of monsters exist to plague mankind. And a monstrous man who nearly attained near immortality before being struck down by a noble king and an alliance of every living race on in that world of Middle Earth. Now, the Ringwraiths were these nine men, these nine human kings who betrayed their people. They betrayed their own, and Sauron promised them immortality. He promised them wealth. He promised that he would make them essentially gods. But then he lied to them, and they died as a result of his lie. They become his slaves. And these slaves, the Nazgul, are said multiple times throughout the novel to be, throughout the novel collection, to be the most terrible servants of Sauron. And of course, he's got all these things, these trolls, these monstrous men known as orcs, who are sort of an amalgamation of man and elf, and horrible goblins and other things that he's got. All sorts of ghosts and ghoulies and monstrous things, dragons, all kinds of terrible things that he's got at his disposal. But these guys are said to be the worst. And why are they the worst? Well, because, for one thing, they're essentially unkillable. They are stuck between this world and death. And wherever they go, death follows. They carve a bloody path through the books. Now, according to the first book within the series, The Lord of the Rings, the Nazgul arose as Sauron's most powerful servants. They were once mortal men, being great lords, and Sauron gave each one of them a ring of power, and ultimately they become to him as his slaves. The corrupting effect of the gifts he gave them extended their earthly lives far beyond their normal lifespans, and some passages in the novels suggest that the Nazgul wore their rings, while others suggest that Sauron actually held them. But what we do know within the story, within the pages of the books, the nine kings became kings and sorcerers and great warriors, and they attained great glory and wealth, but they could not die. And eventually, people began to suspect that they were not human anymore. And of course, that's a problem when you're king of people, and these entities were forced to flee their own kingdoms and bow and scrape before this other lord, Lord Sauron, ultimately forcing this mythos of the Wraiths as a spirit that shirked away, shirked away from duty, were cowardly, were terrible when they were alive, terrible people, and so they were forced into an existence that is both death and life. So an undying existence in which they cannot fully die. They cannot fully pass on to the next world. They are trapped. And these individuals within this context, within the context that Tolkien uses them in, are primary players in the story. They plague the living. They are terrifying to behold. They wear black shrouds. They carry these poisonous swords that he's given them. And they ride throughout the land on horses with flaming eyes, and they murder people. They kill people, and they cry with the voices of death. It is said where they go, they can speak death onto other people. They can speak, and people will die. So that is particularly terrifying when we examine these entities within the story. And for those of you who have seen the movie, and I would love for anybody that has seen the movies to call in, and if they would like to, of course, our call-in number is always 718-508-9883. Anytime anybody wants to call in and talk about the thing that we're talking about would be great. I'm always down to answer questions. Or if you think you've got a better interpretation, I'm always down to listen to that too. I always want to try to remember to put that in there. But sometimes we get going and we get going well. Now, incidentally, what Tolkien does with these beings is he takes a relatively small, obscure story, which is the Wraiths. Wraiths are, again, as I said, there's very little stories written about them. They're, for the most part, relegated to Scotland and ancient Greece. So there's very little written stories about Wraiths and what they do and what they're capable of. What we do know, and what is sort of consistent along the board, is that they're not quite all the way dead, but they're not all the way living. They're trapped. They're in this state of flux. Okay, so when we look at the way that Tolkien adapted this small story, these guys become sort of the perfect engine for this king that he has, because Sauron is also both alive and dead. He possesses no physical form other than a giant flaming eye, because his body was stricken down by mortal king, by a mortal man. He was defeated because of his own arrogance and also because of some blind luck. Sometimes people just get lucky, and sometimes you're just unlucky. And in the case of Sauron, he was incredibly unlucky. But nonetheless, this same characteristics here. So where the Nazgul go, things are cold. They speak death wherever they go. People die. So they are sort of these harbingers of death. Check. And they also, they're also people who were oathbreakers. They betrayed their own people for wealth. They enslaved their own people to Sauron. And by extension, they enslaved themselves eventually. So check. They were terrible people when they're alive. And lastly, they are stuck in this form that they are in. So they are stuck within they are stuck being both alive and dead. So that's another check. And then I should say, lastly, they are very dark characters, and they are driven out only by one thing and one thing only, and that is light. Light is the only thing that repels them. In every situation within the Lord of the Rings, the only thing that causes the Ringwraiths to retreat is light or fire. Those are the only things that seem to afflict them, that seem to scare them. Physicals on them do nothing for the most part. They are only vulnerable during the day. And they also tend to only come out at night. So that kind of makes it a problem. with the exception, of course, of the Witch King of Angmar, who is defeated through heroism and courage by a woman, incidentally. So, you know, that's something to consider as well. But within Tolkien's book, we get all of these same characteristics that we've already covered within the Greek mythos and the Scottish tales of a being that is essentially the result of either a person making poor decisions while they're alive or the result of some forms of black magic being applied and an individual becoming cursed as a wraith. In almost every manifestation of a wraith, wraiths are not positive beings. They are not positive things. And the only thing that can drive out their negativity is positivity. The only thing that can drive out darkness is light. And we've heard this said over and over again in many contexts, and let's not make this, you know, we run the risk of slipping down the religious slope of, oh, the only thing that can drive out the shadows is the power of light and truth and one, you know, yeah. The time immemorial saying of there is always light. But wraiths are a great way to embody, these entities are a great way to embody evil and a great way to embody fear itself. Because again, the only way that we ourselves can overcome and move forward in life is to overcome our fears. And we can only overcome our fears and our insecurities by confronting them head on, right? We can't simply ignore our fears. Wraiths are very disruptive beings in the mythological sense. They're very disruptive. They feed on natural energy. They feed on fear. For them to exist and sustain themselves, there must be fear. Because if there is no fear, they have nothing to feed on and sustain their forms by thereby extending their existence. Because of this, they are a great way of embodying the concept of fear. Because there is only, of course, we have the great old saying of there is nothing to fear but fear itself. Of course, you know, we've got that great quote. And of course, I paraphrased it. One moment. And of course, this is Churchill, for those of you unfamiliar with the quote. And of course, FDR had once said this as well, but within the inaugural address of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he says, "So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory, and I am convinced that you will again give me that support to leadership in these critical days," and blah, 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 blah. And he gives this great, you know, long speech about, you know, the nation and what his plans are as president. But within the first lines, within his inaugural address, let's take a look at this, and I won't read the whole speech, but I do want to revisit the first lines. "First of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance." These entities that we've been talking about today, wraiths, are the embodiment of fear itself. They are fear. They are fear itself. And no matter how you slice it, in every iteration of them, and this is what I think has made wraiths such a lasting theme and tool used to encompass the theme of fear and conflict within stories, and particularly successful stories such as Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, who had not only great success as novels, but also great success and as film adaptations. But I think the reason that these things contribute to that success is we as people, we understand fear. Everybody, no matter how brave, no matter how sure of themselves they are, has fears. And some people would call those doubts. But everybody has some anxiety, some base fear within them, that something that they don't want to confront. We all have that. And in order for us to move forward in life, we have to confront those fears. And these beings, these wraiths, feed on fear, right? They are the embodiment of fear, and the only thing that keeps them going is fear. Thus proving, again, the point Franklin Delano Roosevelt makes in his speech, that we've got nothing to fear but fear itself. Now, when we look at that, a lot of people would say, oh, well, he's just telling us to, you know, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, be brave and be courageous and do great things. Well, yes and no. But I think he's making more of a philosophical statement on fear. And I think these rates are a perfect segue into that philosophical statement. The thing we have to fear is the concept of fear. Then we have to ask ourselves what the concept of fear truly is. Now, if we look at a definition for fear, definitions, and they don't really do a very good job in these dictionaries, in my opinion, of encompassing what fear is, but fear is to have a reverential awe of, or to be afraid of, expect with alarm, to be afraid or apprehensive. But I think the key term that we can look at when we look at fear is apprehension, doubt. The inability to confront what we know to be true. I think this is a perfect opportunity, you know. But one of the things that we have to ask ourselves is, if we have nothing to fear but fear itself, then we have to ask ourselves ultimately, what is it that we fear? And why do we fear it? That's the real question, I think, that's being asked by these writers and by Roosevelt in his inaugural address, is what is it? How can we identify? If we only have fear itself to fear, then how can we identify what it is that fills us with such apprehension? What is it that we are afraid of? Why do we possess fear? Now, psychologists similar sciences, perhaps somebody who works in the social sciences such as sociology, and maybe even some biologists will tell you that fear is a natural emotion that is designed to keep you alive. Fear is a way of letting you know that you're in a situation that you should not be in. Fear is a natural emotion that is supposed to kick in, that is supposed to kickstart your thoughts for self-preservation. At least that's what they would tell you. And perhaps in some examples that might be true. For example, if you're hiking in the woods by yourself and a bear shows up and decides that you might make a tasty snack, it might be a good idea to get moving and get away, remove yourself from that situation. So fear in that situation might encourage you to seek refuge somewhere and pretty quickly. But if you're about to walk into a meeting with your boss, and suddenly you find yourself afraid to walk in the door and demand the raise that you believe you've earned and that you deserve, that's a little bit unhealthy. If you're getting dressed in the morning and you're worried about whether or not everybody's going to accept you because of what you're wearing, that's sort of an unhealthy fear. That's an anxiety, right? These things, and you know, people would say, well, you're conflating the two, but I don't think we're conflating them. I think we're renaming fear is what we're doing in our society today. We're renaming the race. We're changing the name of our ghosts and our demons. We're not really doing anything about them. We're just giving them a new name. And then we're accepting them. Now, everybody's on anti-anxiety pills. Now, don't get me wrong. I certainly wouldn't want to hurt somebody's feelings. I firmly believe that there are people who do struggle with certain feelings of anxiety, perhaps, as a result of traumas that they may experience, and we certainly wouldn't want to be insensitive to that. That's an entirely different story. But where I think we mess up here, and I could be wrong, but where I think we mess up is that we've allowed ourselves to become lazy. We've allowed ourselves to become weak and soft in that we're unwilling to accept confrontation. There are some people out there who are willing to accept confrontation, and by no means am I saying you need to go out there and confront somebody and get into it with somebody. That's not what I'm saying. When I say confrontation, when I say conflict, I mean when we're faced with the slightest bit of adversity, there are so many people now who, when they're faced with the slightest bit of adversity, they cave, they crumble, they've got no response, they don't want to do anything about it, and they're gonna chalk it up as a loss, and they're gonna say, it's because of my anxieties. I can't be successful. My anxieties are preventing this. I could be so much better than I am today, but I'm so anxious. Well, what you're doing there, and then people around them feel sorry for them. They say, oh my gosh, that's so true. That's what's holding you back. No. What's holding you back is your inability to confront what's making you so anxious in the first place. Not everybody's good with public speaking. And that doesn't mean everybody is going to be good at public speaking or should be good at public speaking. But just because you're not good at it doesn't mean you should be deathly afraid of it. What if you have to give a speech at some point in your life? You may have to speak in front of people. And certainly at some point in your life, you're going to be in a situation where you're going to have to talk to people you don't know. Because you don't know everybody. And if you can't get past that anxiety, it's going to be very difficult for you to conduct yourself as a normal functioning human being in our society. That's going to be a problem. And somehow, every single day, people manage to get past that. People manage to get past that and get a job and go about their day. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure there are some people who don't. But there is something, somehow, some magical way people manage to overcome this. Time. It takes prodding from other people. It takes prodding. It takes time. It takes that great internal struggle. But see, it's my opinion when we look at this, and this is simply my opinion, and it can be disagreed with, but I'm of the opinion that we have simply come up with more creative ways to recast the ghosts and monsters in our lives. We've come up with different ways of making excuses instead of going after results. We've come up with different ways of making fear normal, making it okay to be afraid of things all the time. And we shouldn't do it. And we shouldn't encourage it. That doesn't mean we get rid of all the medicines that treat anxiety and we get rid of the therapy and all that stuff. No. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying is we should be encouraging people to step out of their comfort zone every once in a while and confront what it is that makes them anxious. And I think that there would be plenty of people who'd be willing to agree with me on this, that the only way you can really make progress when you have some anxiety or when you have some fear is to step out of your comfort zone. I remember particularly personally for me, I remember being a little bit suffering a little bit from a case of stage fright. I didn't like getting up in front of people and talking. But then I had to take public speaking in high. I had to take speech in high school, and then I had to take public speaking in college. And then when I got to doing my master's, I had to, I had to read conference papers in front of people who had read my paper before I got there, who would know whether or not I was lying about what I was talking about in my paper, who I couldn't just simply fake it until I made it, which made me confront. Made me so antsy about getting up there and talking in front of people. What worried me about getting up and talking in front of people was that I would say something stupid or that I would be unprepared. So the way that I countered that was, well, then I'll just be prepared. So instead of just simply going into it and writing a paper and putting it out there and not really familiarizing myself with my material, I got to reading my paper over and over and over and over again, reading my speeches over and over and over again, and trying to memorize them and trying to get more comfortable with them. And with this came confidence. And this allowed me to do what I needed to do, what I had to do, and that was get up in front of these people and present my work, be proud of my work, and prepare myself for the bombardment of questions about my work. To face criticism and overcome that criticism, because understanding that criticism doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong. It simply means somebody has a different point of view, and being able to confront that head on without, losing your cool is something that we all work on. It's something that I still work on. But being able to do that in front of a group of people made me a better public speaker. It made me able to face that head on. And now I don't have that anxiety anymore, obviously, because here I am on the air talking to all of you guys. And of course, I've done Facebook Live feed after Facebook Live feed before this. And of course, on Sundays, I stream both here and on Facebook Live as well with Straight Football Talk. And so this is, for me, I think this particular story, these rates, this very physical manifestation of fear itself, to me, it's something I can relate to. And I hope you guys can relate to it, too. I hope you are able to face the wraiths in your life. And remember that you don't have to be afraid. There's nothing wrong with experiencing feelings of intimidation or trepidation when going into endeavors. There's nothing wrong with caution. But don't be so cautious that you don't take chances. Don't be so cautious that you miss out on the good things in life. Because if you're overcautious, if you're afraid all the time, you'll never experience the great things in life that there is available to you. You'll never go out and chase the dreams that you have because you'll be too scared. I'd like to encourage everybody today, look at your life today and try to find the wraiths in your life. Try to find those things in your life that fill you with dread. What is it that you're intimidated by doing? What is it that you think, what are those doubts that weigh on your mind? And then think about those for a little bit. Mull those over. Think about what you can do. If it's something out of your control, if it's a fear of the future, if it's a fear of what is to come, of things that have yet to happen yet, then I would urge you to just let those things go and not worry about them because they're out of your control. And there's no reason, no logical reason to be afraid of things out of your control. If there's nothing you can do about it, well, being afraid over it is really not going to help you a whole lot because then you're just going to be miserable. But if it's something in your control, something you can fix, think about what it would take for you to move past it. What does it take for you to confront it? Maybe it's a person. Maybe it's a thing. You know, maybe you're afraid of dogs. Maybe you're just absolutely petrified of dogs. Maybe you get with somebody that has a puppy. And you break yourself of that fear by going, and maybe you don't have to get up close and personal with it right away. But maybe you just start researching dogs and understanding dogs and getting to know more about them. And the more you'll learn about them, the more you're going to find that they're probably not as scary as you thought they were. And then maybe you take the next step. The next step is confronting that fear face to face. So first step, you got to educate yourself on what you're afraid of, so you have to understand it first. That's step one. Understanding it, understanding what you're afraid of, and recognizing it is step one. Step two, after you've identified the things that are wraiths in your life, and you understand them, now it's time for the next step. Now we must confront them. And once you've confronted them, once you've confronted the wraiths in your life, and you've moved past this, the next step is letting it all go. Just letting go of that, of those feelings. Now that you've encountered what it was you were afraid of, and you realize that there's really nothing too scary about what you had to confront, the next thing on your list is moving on and enjoying that newfound freedom that you're going to have now that you have moved beyond this anxiety, this fear that has consumed you. And drink deep the cup of life, because every day is precious. And life is just too short to waste on wraiths. Guys, I hope you've enjoyed today's show. I hope you learned a little bit about it. And if you're interested in learning a little bit more about wraiths, then you can take a look at, and I know it's going to be fiction, but you could take a look at the series written by Tolkien, Lord of the Rings series. You can look at the play Macbeth. They feature prominently there. You can look at the story of Orpheus in Greek mythology. Of course, the Iliad also has shades and wraiths appear prominently. And you could look at the Harry Potter series if you're interested in looking at that. But I would also recommend taking a look at Edith Hamilton's mythology. And, of course, always a good start, always something good to start with when you're looking at Greek myths is Homer's The Iliad. So I hope you guys have enjoyed today's segment, and I hope that it's encouraged you to take the time to confront the things in your life that have brought you down. Maybe there's things that you're afraid of in life, but you don't have to be afraid. And once you realize that there is nothing to fear but fear itself, you can overcome it. No wraith can take your joy away unless you let it. So I hope you guys have enjoyed learning about wraiths and where they come from and how they've been so impactful in popular culture. And I hope that it encourages you to live a rich life and to take some chances and to enjoy all the opportunities that life has in store for you. That's all I've got for you guys today. You guys can catch me live tomorrow, actually, tomorrow night at 8 p.m. We're going to be talking about Bigfoot. I'm going to actually be guest on somebody else's show. I will be back on Saturday instead of Sunday for the Straight Football Talk segment, because this week we had to move our show to Saturday. It's going to be at 5 on Saturday. We'll be talking to Kerry Rhodes in an interview, and of course we'll be talking fantasy football. We'll be talking about the latest in football news, of course the injuries to several star players throughout the league. I have sort of shaken up the landscape a little bit. The incredible Cardinals debut by Adrian Peterson, who looked like a man revived, a man rejuvenated in his first appearance with the Arizona Cardinals. very impressive. The unfortunate and crippling injury of Aaron Rodgers, of course, will be up for discussion, how that changes the landscape in the NFL. And the surprising upsets of this latest week of football. That's all going to be coming to you Saturday. And, of course, Sunday, don't forget to catch our Best Little Horror Pod Texas at 7 p.m. on Sunday and TDR Rocks at 4 p.m. on Sunday. Guys, I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. I'll catch you guys tomorrow when we talk about Bigfoot.